Hi everyone, welcome to this webinar on reducing risk in startup medtech. I'm Mike Brennigan-Harris, CEO of Device Access UK. We are a medtech market access consultancy, been around for 10 years this week actually, and we've got a great panelist today to talk through their views and opinions on market access and medtech and success and failure stories of, we're trying to really help medtech and investors understand the principles of market access and how they can be more successful. Because at the end of the day, the two biggest losers in this whole game are the patients when great technologies get to market and the investors. But they're also the biggest, as I say, the biggest losers as well when things fail. So we'll go through, I'll introduce you to each of the panelists shortly. Bit more about us. We are, as I say, a market access consultancy. We help the medtech industry understand activity across the NHS. We have access to NHS patient level data, so we can look and see what how the NHS treat patients. We can look at waiting lists, which we're doing a lot of at the moment, and understanding the opportunity, particularly in the COVID-19 situation. We offer a very fast-track health economic publication service to get the evidence of health economic and cost-effectiveness out into the world. We have been responsible for taking over 30 technologies through NICE, and a number of those has hit the news, including this one. So that's a bit about us. When I talk about medtech, and one of the things I always ask my clients, and hoping they can answer the question, is the same question that NICE ask medtech companies if they are going to submit to their programs, where they evaluate the safety, efficacy, and cost effectiveness of new medical devices. And that is called PICO. And I would encourage all investors to talk to any potential medtech companies, asking the question about who needs the technology, what's the population, how big is the population that needs this specific piece of kit, understand what the new intervention, what the new piece of kit does. But importantly, is fully understanding how the current treatment pathway is going. What is the comparator? How are these patients being treated today? And then the outcome is the really in-depth part is, what's the difference between how the patients are treated at the moment, the comparator, and with the new interventions? So PICO is paramount to conversations at all levels, includes NHS and NICE, etc. And as I say, I encourage investors to think of that in the back of their mind, and inventors as well, of course. The other important thing to consider is what we consider are the actual principles of market access. Market access isn't properly defined as a science, and so we try and define it as these four principles, which differ from the principles of marketing, which are product, price, place, promotion, which was a 1960s method of selling fast moving consumer goods. We see the principles of market access as making sure that whatever you do, whatever you design, whatever you invest in, benefits primarily patients, making sure that they benefit from the technology, and then making sure that the provider of care, the hospital that treats a patient, benefits from using the piece of technology, and that the payer benefits from paying the hospital to treat the patient. I think that's really important that you think of it that way, to make sure that you have a really good value story. And like four pillars, these are like the game of Connect Four. Get these four lined up and you often win. And we've seen it over the last 10 years of working with hundreds of medical device companies, and getting these things aligned is a really important thing, principles of market access. The last part, the last P benefit, is the product benefit. And that is really the company, the product, the value, which is so important from an investment side. It's about optimizing your sales price, but making sure that the technology gets to the right patient. And that requires a lot of skill, because you fully need to understand the patient, provider, and payer benefits to understand the full value of the technology before you actually come to a selling price. Marketing is essentially a interview-based price, or a margin over manufacturing costs, which is not very scientific. And for many companies that only focus on selling the product to the provider and not to the payer, they lose out on the long-term benefit of a technology that could benefit the patient, the provider, and payer, and put a price behind that, not just on the value to the provider of care. Consider the payer it helps to optimize your sales price. So that's my bit over in terms of some advice to those that are listening about market access in general and the importance within investment. So we have been running lots of webinars, and you can see them on YouTube. And this is one we did recently about evidence with NICE. But what I'd like to start by doing now is introducing the panelists. And I'm going to start ladies first with Angela. Angela Hobbs from Wilkinson Hall. Angela, welcome to the webinar. Love to you to introduce yourself and tell me about yourself and how you got here.
Thank you very much. Thanks for that introduction. So I spent the last few years until 2019 working in a product design consultancy, helping startups and entrepreneurs bring medtech products to market. While I was doing that, it was an incredible opportunity and a privilege to see some really brilliant ideas. And one of my frustrations was when sometimes you could really see what benefit that particular piece of medtech would bring, and then for some reason it would fail along the way. And that's for me why this webinar today, talking about reducing the risk and also reducing the cost of failure to the medtech company themselves, is so interesting. While I was in my role as MD, I also sat on several investment panels. So I've had a lot of opportunities to see new ideas. I worked as a volunteer for the Design Council and Versus Arthritis, and on a competition called Imagine If, which is based in Oxford, where I live and work. And I currently, along running my own company, work as a consultant with Oxford University Innovation on their incubator program.
Well, thanks, Angela. Great background. So great to have you on the webinar. Over to you, Matt. Love to hear introduce yourself and your background.
Hi there. So Matt Campbell-Hill. I was a founding member of the Medical Technologies Advisory Committee for NICE. I reviewed about 300 medical devices as part of that committee over 9 and a bit years. During that time, I also spent a couple of years on their Technology Appraisals Committee B, which looked at advanced pharmaceuticals, reviewing about 60 advanced pharmaceuticals. I'm an ex-non-executive director of the MHRA, the Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, and I was an independent board member for the National Information Board, where I led on the rollout of apps, adoption and rollout of apps as medical devices across the NHS, as well as public access Wi-Fi. When I left the MHRA in the second half of 2018, I joined the University of Birmingham College of Medical and Dental Sciences as the first senior fellow in medical technology design and adoption. And as some of people will know me at the moment, I launched Aerosol Shield as a response to, designed to launch Aerosol Shield as a response to COVID in 6 days. And we went international within 13 days from being told about the indication. So that's the Aerosol Shield Limited link at the moment.
That's great, thanks. So Stuart, welcome, MedTech Investor. I'd love to you to introduce yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. By way of background, so my background is more in the software technology side of things. So I was part of a team which set up a company back in 2009, which was in the social media space, social media data. And we ended up selling that company at the end of 2014 to a company called King.com. So most famous for making Candy Crush, that mobile phone game that some of you might be familiar with. And then from there, early 2015, I fell more into the investing side of things. And over the last couple of years, that has gathered more steam. And so up to a portfolio of around about 60 startups invested in, of which close to 20 of them are in some way related to health tech or med tech, however you want to define it. And that covers the whole range from digital tools through to diagnostic tools, hardware, some drug candidates in there, drug discovery. And we are a global investor and invest typically early, so anything pre-series A, so along that seed stage, with valuations, company valuations tending to be anywhere between a few hundred thousand pound up to, let's say, sort of 10 million pound at sort of the upper end. So that's where we would typically play in that space.
So very sort of early startup stuff then, Stuart. And where are you seeing the technologies coming from at the moment in the world?
So if we look at our portfolio, it's predominantly for the medical side of things. It's predominantly the UK and the US, where we do have a couple of companies out in Canada. But looking at, and we've got one in Latin America, a diagnostic tool, one in Denmark, and a few others spread out. But the bulk of them are in the UK and the US, and that's pretty evenly split across what we see.
Okay, that's just interesting to know. Right. So I've got a number of questions here to roll out on today's webinar. And I'm starting off with you, really, Stuart, what do investors want?
So very much, it depends on the stage that the investor is investing at. So for us, although we invest very early compared to a lot of others, anywhere along that sort of seed phase, when it comes to medical investment, we do want to see that the company has to some degree managed to de-risk the technology as much as they can, and depending on the type of product that is, that can vary in how they do that. So if we're speaking to somebody who has an idea or who has something which has shown some promise in some sort of early stage lab test, that may be a little bit too early for us, and we'll want them to actually go out and show some greater de-risking of the technology. So that may be building prototypes, if it's a hardware tool, if it's diagnostics, it's showing that they've got some promising early data which shows that their technology is on path to be able to, let's say, attain whatever the gold standard measurement is for the disease that they're looking to measure. If it's for drug discovery, it might be, okay, well, where have you got to? Have you completed toxicity studies before going out to raise funding, or what can you do which is sort of cheap and easy to get some progress? A lot of the time we do see companies where they have it in their mind that they need to raise money to do a lot of this. And I think depending on the background, a lot of these companies may come from academia, where actually it's very drilled into them that they have to be very rigid in their approach. And one of the things we try to like to see within the entrepreneurs we back is people who are willing to be more willing to, let's say, hack the system, or how can you do things a bit quick and dirty, but to get some proof of concept or proof of safety, or to de-risk things before we were then to jump in.
Okay, that was very helpful. Thanks, Stuart. I mean, it's obviously a very stressful and time-sensitive time for companies. And I know, Angela, in your previous role, you'd meet a lot of these companies would come and meet with you and try and get you to design and manufacture prototypes and new devices. But what was it like for you? What's your view on what Stuart said from his side? And you know, what do MedTech want?
That's really, really valuable information from Stuart, and so relevant. I wish I could have had access to that some time ago and given it to everyone I spoke to. Really valuable information. I think in the beginning, in early stage, medtech companies really need a very clear understanding of the regulatory impacts. They need a regulatory strategy, and often they're prohibited from doing that financially, because sometimes to get external help and to get the right kind of guidance and support just when you need it can be cost prohibitive to them. So I think there's a need for what information can medtech companies access early enough in their development to stop them making those mistakes, which can be so easily avoided. I don't know whether any of the panel have seen that recently, I think it was just at the end of March, UK Innovate UK and BSI collaborated and produced a responsible innovation guide. It's publicly available specification. It's called 440/2020. And I would encourage anyone who's developing a medtech product at the moment just to have a look at it. It's free. You can download it. It's got some really interesting guidance and information. And I'd like to see a lot more of that for medtech companies.
That's very helpful. Thanks, So moving on to you, Matthew, your world in sort of regulatory sort of side, you know, what do they want? And I mean, I know there's been massive changes recently with the European MDR dates being put back another year, but what's your take on it?
I think, well, firstly, to clarify, actually, I cover wider areas than just medical technology. I really spend most of my time, it feels like, covering communications around technologies in highly regulated spaces. So, and that does obviously include medical technology, as I started with, but I'm also working with the DVSA and looking at how that's going to change for driving and vehicle standards. But I think we're not going to get much more clarity from the MHRA and whilst we've still got Brexit as not an open door, but it's certainly not firmly shut and sealed up and everything's done and dusted and the keys in the lock and walked away. So I think that's going to make it a bit difficult. But that does slightly bring me on to what I was thinking, as Stuart was saying. It was really helpful listening to Stuart talk about when people come in, what you're looking for. And I think there's a lot of work that people aren't doing in early states because perhaps they expect to be paid. And whilst that means on the one hand that development of a new product is potentially reserved for the privileged few who can afford some available time. There is that reality of you don't get paid for an idea until you've actually got something behind it. So I would start with there, and I would start that people should be looking at what is the regulatory requirement of the product that I'm coming into. It seems like such a basic thing to be saying on the one hand, but as you will hear later, I've had experiences where people haven't been able to understand that requirement. So looking at any marketplace, whether it's healthcare or it doesn't matter, it just doesn't matter. What is the regulatory requirements on this product that I'm making? And that is where you've got to, as soon as you've got your idea and you've got your first idea down on paper, you've got to sit back and say, right, what does this look like? Who do I need to get that advice from? And if it is coming from academics, then actually that advice to them is free from within their institutions or within their networks. So, but with regards to your specific question, Mike, I'm afraid I couldn't increase any clarity on what's going to happen in regulation in the short term. The medium term to long term, I think it will look very much as it did about 5 years ago. I think it will come back round to where we were. There will be, especially post what's going on now, post this pandemic, the drive for coherence and recognition of standards and within regulation to have an international standard will be so strong that I think it'll be very difficult to not end up back where close to where we were or even better.
So, I mean, the typical market access journey that the sort of companies that come to device access are often those that have got CE marked or about to get CE marked. And sort of when they do, they sort of arrive, land in the hospitals trying to sell their products. And unfortunately for many of them, they use these what we call principles of marketing to sell their products and use the words of innovation, cheaper, better, faster, but without much evidence around that from a health economics side. And it seems that a lot of decisions, I'd love to have other people's opinions on this, but a lot of companies are driven to doing research because they'll go into a hospital that wants to do research because doctors like doing research. They get paid to do it. The hospitals get rewarded for doing research as well. There's a fantastic research infrastructure here in the UK for research in English language and fast and on track through the NIHR, who I'd recommend. But you know, the question I always say is, what are you doing this research study for? Who is it for? Is it for the doctors to talk about on a podium somewhere glamorous in America, or is there a reason behind this for a bigger goal. For example, you know, the work that we do is getting technologies approved by NICE or recommended by NICE. And so we see a lot of people doing research, clinical research, but so few of them doing the economic work. And economics is so important because at some stage, and I think, you know, for all countries now, money's going to tighten up and they're going to need to show value in a way that they haven't done before. So unfortunately, those companies that don't understand the true value of the technology, the journey for them often leads to them going to talk to a consultant surgeon. The surgeon saying, I like that. Yeah, I'll try a box of 10. Go and talk to my theatre manager. The theatre manager agreeing that it would be a nice idea and it will keep Mr. Jones, the consultant surgeon, happy if they use this piece of kit. So go and talk to John in procurement. And then you're basically facing a guy that buys cornflakes and crepe bandages. And he's now asked to buy a complex medical device without understanding the value. And that's where the downward pricing pressure negotiation starts, because nobody's sure of the real value. And that's sort of how many journeys go in this NHS market access situation. And I think it's sad because nobody's getting the real value. The conversation's probably with the wrong people in procurement. The value of the technology has not been taken to the corridors of the hospital that are carpeted, that can see the real value of it. And I think that leads to a loss of opportunity for profit, for value, and for valuation of these companies. And what we've seen is, over the years, many companies — we work predominantly with North American startup companies that want to come to the UK, bring their technologies in, they bring some fantastic technologies. They understand that reimbursement is important, that there has to be a mechanism of these things being bought, which often isn't considered. These companies think they can sell the products, but they may not understand the buying infrastructure of a healthcare system to buy it. And then you know, it leads to a very long journey. But if that's done properly, and the sort of companies we work with, as I say, from North America, they can take the technology through NICE, and that adds global value to the technology, which has led to some very big hundreds of millions of dollars of acquisitions. So I think that's something that I just wanted to say about not really valuing up what the technology does and getting the maximum out of the product benefit. But Angela, what's your view on the market access journey for these companies? Do you think they're considering that early on as well?
I think that for many, my experience, many of the companies I work with were at very early stage. And one of the things that it seems like an obvious thing to say, but there were many times that I would say, you know, before you get into the costs and the complexities of developing prototypes, do the research with the users. Who's going to use it? Why would they use your product more than anyone else's? What problem are you solving, and why are you solving it better than anyone else? And over what period of time can you do that at a cost-effective value proposition? So really detailed but fairly obvious questions and user research to help inform that development. And then I would always want to see medical device companies prototyping frequently and at as low a cost as possible before they approach CE marking, to make sure that what they're doing in the right way, that's aligned with potential investors, and it's aligned with the market they're aiming for. I think that one of the very successful companies I worked with was a company called Zilliqo, who invested a great deal in developing their idea and developing what they wanted to bring to market, and constantly evaluating what it could do for the patient. It's a diagnostic system used to works with colposcopy to provide assessments of cervical cancer. Their route to market, the dedication of their team, the constant testing and engagement with users was really, really valuable. And it's led to a very successful route to market for them. And I think that's one of the most essential things that companies have to do.
Sure. And what Matt, what do you think the biggest mistakes are that these companies make?
I think, to be honest, you just heard it, that patient adherence, patient desire, and patient understanding, if that's the way the device is going to be used, are really, really important. And there are so many patient groups out there that are literally shouting with caps locks on all social media, saying, someone please talk to us, someone please listen to us. Actually, it's a really good place to start. If you're wanting to get into medtech, and you know you've got a team of intelligent people around you, or you're a good designer or whatever, but you're looking for something, that's the starting point. It's a great starting point. What are the issues that are causing them continual headaches? What's slowing their progress through their health journey? What keeps them in hospital? What stops them from getting back to work? Those are the sort of things that will enable people to buy into what you're getting, both what you're making, both from a financial point of view, as well as just that basic, yes, but this is what we want. So yeah, there's very, very little more I'd add to that, unless if it's a device where the patient, or a product that the patient doesn't really have a direct interaction from, then again, it just comes down to it's your user group, and the user group will be the clinical team or whomsoever it is, and making sure that they actually want this, that you're not going to be causing another issue for them down the line, or just inventing something that only works with that one particular hospital. That's really key. And that comes back, I think, Mike, to what you were saying about getting brought in to do some interesting research and being sold on really interesting research, as it were. But actually, then you find out it was only interesting to that one hospital, or that small group of clinicians. So if you're going to go and do something in Birmingham, who can you find in Glasgow? If you've got clinicians approaching you from Portsmouth, they will know other people around the country. So okay, fine, who else can you introduce me to from a different part of the country that I can talk to independently and get a feel for what this actually looks like before we start throwing money away? Because one of the things I find so frustrating is when you'll see products are actually quite good, but then, or some research that's good, and it's fine to redo research a couple of times to prove the research, but you just get endless iterations of of people requesting funding for redoing research projects, or a slight change in that project, or to slightly modify a device. Really, you start to question, why are you doing that? Is it actually going to make a fundamental difference to that patient group, or to your work working with that patient group or that device? Or is it actually that you just want to have something attached to it? And I think that's got to be a very clear conversation between within the teams, and then the scientists, anyone outside that's helping with the data or the science, but importantly for the investors. And I think the majority of investors are quite good at doing that, but with the ease of using apps as medical devices, I think that's where it gets a bit concerning, that people won't necessarily know what the legal requirements are for a medical product compared to a normal wellness app or just a normal app. So it's making sure that you get a wider understanding of wider amount of people to give you a proper understanding of, is this the right product? Is this what people want? And is it going to cause me any regulatory headaches?
Sure. I mean, it's really interesting you touching on the patient, the importance of patient feedback, because I mean, I'm sure you'll agree with me, Matt, your time at NICE, you know, patient voice is so important to NICE and NHS England. They listen very much to what patients think of technologies, don't they?
Very much so. The Patient Public Involvement Programme has been running pretty much as long as NICE, and it's not about the individual patients with a burning flag telling you about all of the problems, which, you know, we have seen in the past. It's not about that. It's far more considered, and that's what NICE have been very good at doing. And it's part of the model that I've used when I've gone into certain companies who are trying to roll out new products at national or international levels, is where is that conversation? Where is that ongoing conversation? Because it's really important. It's really good feedback. You get, you obviously you'll have your non-executive board, and we always call them your critical friends, but actually you've got a much wider group of critical friends. And there's one thing that I often talk about is find the way that if you think your product can help in various ways, maybe you've got three or four indications you think it can help with. Okay, that's fine. But find where you really knock it out of the park. Where you're really, really strong. What do you identify as being your strongest point? Right. Then go and find that interest group. And especially one who are at present marginalized. So it could be that actually you aim this technology to work with 93% of the population. But the last 7% of that population, or the last 8% of that population, the hardest ones to get within that population group, go and work with them. If they are a specific group, maybe with a disability, maybe they're the deaf community, maybe they're wheelchair users, whatever it is, go and find them. Because actually they are difficult, more difficult for the NHS to work with. They are more costly for the NHS to work with. And if you can go in and say, this group really like what we do, it makes it better for them. You've got a really easy test group who are helping you, who are really keen to get things going. And if it doesn't work for them, well then fine, you can narrow it down, but you'll probably get some good problem solving done at the same time. But if it does work for them, that's really important, because you're showing that with your hardest group, or with a group that is already a concern for the NHS, and rightly so, because maybe they're marginalized, we're delivering a service that you can't deliver at the moment. And even if you were going to deliver it, it would cost you more than we're doing it for the moment. So you tick quite a few boxes. And that leads you into a thing, funnily enough, which is something we were usually quite worried about in MTAC, which is usage creep. So if you say this is for a particular group and it worked very well, will it then start being used in a wider fora or for a wider group of patients? Yes, probably it will. So actually, as a medical device manufacturer, that's a really good bonus, because if you can show it works for the hardest to reach, it's definitely going to work for the easy ones.
No, thank you for that, Matt. I mean, Stuart, from your side, how important is it for you to hear about patient involvement at early stage startup?
It depends on the type of product, but if it's something which is patient centric, then very much so. And it's particularly at the early stages. I think as Matt and Angela have said, there are so many, let's say, patient groups out there on Facebook, support groups, and it's so easy to access these people and to get their insight and to get their feedback. And the vast majority of them don't want money in return. They just want to be heard, and they're willing to give you their time to do that. And so if it's something where the patient is likely to be involved in that decision making, then very much so we want the company or the startup we're speaking to take very much an iterative approach. So one good example of that, which is a wearable device which we are currently evaluating for an investment, it's around Parkinson's. So they've trialed it on, I think, over 100 patients over the last couple of years, and each time they'll go do some user testing, take it back, iterate on the hardware, make it more comfortable, make it easier to put on, make it less heavy, depending on what the feedback is. And as such, they're in a much stronger position now with their product than they were 2 years ago when they thought they had it nailed, because they've gone and they've done that user research, and now they have a product which is much more likely to get patient adopted. And that's going to be critical as they go. They want to be classed as a medical device, so they then need that adherence through the clinical trials to make sure that the patients are using it properly. And that's going to be they'll have a much higher percentage because they've done that work and that user testing up front.
I think that's quite interesting, though. Like, can I just jump in on that? Because it'd be great to know actually. Obviously, you couldn't share it, but what the numbers are there doing the testing? Because when you're looking at something like Parkinson's, where the patient numbers are huge, But also the variability in the type of patient. Yes, there's usually they are older patients, but otherwise it's both men and women. The variabilities just run on and on, don't they? How many iterations you do before you take an acceptance that actually this is the one that's going to ensure we can get the widest population group? I'm not suggesting this has happened in this case, but I just flag it up as don't go down the rabbit hole of keeping doing iterations and research. At some point, you do have to bite the bullet and say, we're not going to get 100% people. We're going to get our best cross-section we can. What is a target we should aim for that? And that is the bit to review, because there may be a bit we say, okay, well, actually, we're only going to be able to work with 50%, but with that defined 50%, we can do X, Y, Z. So I just raise that as a potential.
Yeah, definitely. I think that is a good point, and it is. You can boil it to death as well. You can 80% of the work in 20% of the time, and then you can spend the remaining 80% of the time to try and eke out those additional 20% improvements. And it's knowing that balance where, okay, actually a couple of rounds of iterations would bring us on leaps and bounds, and then we should put in a design freeze and get through clinical trials with a device, knowing that we can. That it's good enough, and then we can make improvements over time, because otherwise you can end up in a position where nothing is ever good enough, and then you never get to market. And going back to some of the points which were raised earlier, I think the floor is littered with great technology which never made it to market, for that being one of the reasons, and because they weren't able to get it out, or they took too long, or they weren't able to sell it. And then that is a real danger, that the best technology rarely is the technology that wins, sadly.
Yeah, it's a bit of a sad story. That I was interested, you know, we and I deal with companies that come with great technologies, and then they go and talk to a doctor and they'll say, oh, have you tried it for that? And then they go off on a 6-month burning cash adventure thinking that there's more milk and honey with it being used in another indication. And I think that's that can be a very expensive journey for companies to stay off what they were originally going to do, but then it can lead to a great scenario as well. From an investor perspective, what's your thoughts when you get companies that come to you, Stuart, and they say, well, we started off with this and then we tried it and then people liked it, but they thought it was going to be bigger than this. So we just spent, you know, £5 million by going along this journey because we think this is the right one. What's the credibility of that, and how does that make you decide whether to put your cash in or not, Stuart?
Yeah, so it is situational, and it depends on case by case, and so it is a case of trying to look at, okay, well, what have you got today? How promising does that look? Okay, what else do you have in your pipeline? How promising do they look, and what are the costs associated with each of them? For example, we are speaking to an early stage company who are developing a drug at the moment, and they're about to embark on some filings, which would mean that this drug has potentially 3 or 4 different applications, and we're trying to work out, well, actually, how much does it cost to do some initial in vitro and animal studies for these other applications to see whether or not the potential for those is greater, and is it worth doing some of those studies now? And for example, I think a couple of the quotes, one of the mouse models was 15, 20 grand. We're like, okay, well, maybe that might be one worth doing. Another one was sort of 80, 100 grand. We're like, well, okay, do we have 80 or 100 grand, or do we think that's a cost we want to spend now? Probably not. And so it is, I don't know, there's an easy sort of solid answer where you can say this is the right answer. I think it is case by case, and weighing up what in each individual company's cash position is, burn rate, what are the risks involved, how good is their current device or molecule versus what they think they can get with some improvements.
But also the risk benefit analysis, right? Because so if your 80 to 100k one, if that were a case that it were it to come through, it would give you an access to a £10 billion a year market in an underserved medical market compared to the 20 grand, which is going to give you access to a £5 billion market, but in a very well-served medical market, then perhaps the risk changes. And yes, although you don't have the cash available, it then does open you up to, by looking at underserved areas, it opens you up to other possibilities for grants and funding.
Yeah, definitely. So it's sort of weighing all these factors and trying to come up with something which seems like a sensible path forward.
Angela, what's your view on that? Did you see many companies start with one thing and end up with a completely different device? And sort of what difference does that make to their success factor?
Yes, I have seen that, particularly with investment opportunities. So I've seen companies with a very particular strong focus on one market where they've known that market really well. And then because of the investor they've partnered with, they've been persuaded to look at another market for entry and then revert back to that other one afterwards when they've had significant success. I haven't seen that happen successfully. I think there a lot of times that can just mean the company can go off track. They can be going into a market where initially the financial rewards may look more appealing, but in terms of long-term value and the original plan of that company with a series of products can then be disrupted and it doesn't work successfully. So I think that I would always look at that really, really carefully and challenge, if you're going to pivot, if you're going to change, why are you doing it? What's the long-term success rate? What does it mean for the long-term value of your product? And how much will you have to change and adapt that product to go to the market you originally intended it for? So I think they're really very important questions that medtech developers have to consider very, very carefully.
Yeah, and just following up on Angela's points, I think there is a dance between investors and company. So, you know, I can think of one of the companies I've invested in who ended up changing tack because an investor came along and put in $30 odd million into the company, and that was with the understanding that they would then move slightly and go down a different route, which they did. And at the other times, we've spoken to very promising companies where actually they're going after something which might be a very small market because they have some sort of personal affiliation to that, based on it's a disease which has affected someone in their family, and although what they're going after might actually have bigger impact and from an investor standpoint more lucrative impact elsewhere, they are unwilling to change because it has a personal significance to them, and that can be a reason which we wouldn't invest if they're going after a small market. So there is a sort of a funny dance between investors and startups as well.
Stuart, what do you think about one organization I've worked with in the past had a very clear pathway set ahead, and they'd gone through a few different rounds, and the science was very clear for them. But with the way the markets have changed in general, obviously her money, the availability of finances has changed. My understanding is that they've had a new investor come on board who has done that switch for them and said, actually, this is the way we want to go. How does that conversation happen from the investor's point of view? If you're coming into they're not really a startup anymore once they've been several years down the line, but they're still in that growth phase. How do your side, the funder side of it, come to that decision that they're going to come in and essentially tell the scientists, actually, this is the route we think needs to go?
So we're in the conversations where we've been, let's say, the ones leading that, saying we think there's opportunity to look at other areas. It's very much we try to do it emotionlessly, in that we will try and look at the data and just say, well, what is this current market size? Who else is playing in that space versus what is this other market size? How big is that? Is that less competitive? Are there pros or cons to entering that market versus the other? And try to have that as a discussion with the company. So going into a company, we would never try and, at least ourselves, we would never try and dictate that a company should do X, Y, Z. Ultimately, we see our role as investors is largely, in the vast majority of cases, to support the entrepreneur and their company and to help them on that journey, rather than to to drive it ourselves. And then anytime we would try and do that, as if there was a case where we thought something was fundamentally flawed with the company or the approach, but most of the time that isn't true. But in the case where I mentioned where the investor came in with a rather large investment for an early stage company, that was happily accepted by the entrepreneur, because the investor also came in with contacts and the ability to say, well, look, if you can do this, I've got a ready-made black book of people who would be interested in being potential customers for this. And so there, the decision, let's say, was slightly easier because it brought benefit to it, but that won't always be.
Because they had a market, they came in with a market ready.
The market was already there, definitely a very large market. There was an opportunity for them to get in and to bring product to market relatively quickly, and to have buyers, in essence, lined up for at least meetings, if not to actually buy. So there, all the stars aligned. It, on paper, it made sense, and they're sort of 18 months or 2 years into that journey, and so far they're making good progress. Still a bit early to tell if it ultimately will be successful, but they're on a good path.
Mike, can I continue and ask Angela and Stuart another question that others might find interesting?
Yeah, please do.
So one of the things that I often find myself trying to bite my lip and trying not to laugh out loud about is what entrepreneurs think is a reasonable percentage to sell at various stages. And I wonder how you have both done that education piece. Now, I think for the most part, people are educated, for want of a better term, by Dragon's Den. They see the TV program and they see these numbers waved around, and that's what they take from that. Then they add that to the idea that they will have read about the COPD market is £3.5 billion a year in the UK, something like that. And they will formulate a cost. And this isn't all, but this is certainly my experience, a large number of entrepreneurs. So when it comes down to any discussions around percentage of ownerships, they are way off what is a reasonable understanding of not just what they're selling, but what the investors should be bringing in. So is it worth, Angela, sort of starting with you and saying, what is it, how do you educate these people in a minute about what they should be expecting to part with, but also what they should be expecting to gain from the investors rather than just the cash?
Thank you. And it's a really good point. And yes, I think that expectations are always far higher than they should be. There's such a culture of innovation. I said earlier, I live and work in Oxford. I think everyone innovates. It's practically a requirement, which is really exciting. And it's wonderful to be in that buzzing, lively growth market of medical devices. But the realization of what you have to give up in your idea, your concept, your device, in order to get the investment you need to take it to the valuation you might imagine, is an equation that doesn't always seem to balance. And I frequently talk as well to early stage companies about what kind of investor do you want to have? How much advice do you need? What speciality do you need from that investor? What kind of relationship do you want? Do you want the investors who are working very closely with you? Are you going to take their guidance? Or are you simply looking for investment and then the expectation is the miracle will appear, your product will be in the market, the growth will be huge, and it's just success all along the way. So I think a healthy dose of realism of how hard it is, that investors are constantly sought out for new products and new devices. They have ideas in plenty that they can look at. What makes yours the one that they may consider to take further? And what do you need to do to get their attention, keep their attention, and then gain that valuable investment? I think it's really, really important point.
And that keeping their attention is really important, especially financially. And equally, they want to keep your attention. So they don't. Investors are not interested in bullying people out of their own companies. If, on the whole, if they arrive, it's because there's a good a good team's had a good idea, but they need support, whether it's just financial or financial and staff. But that, I think part of that is the look at the size of the pie that you're getting. You've got no pie at the moment. You know, a slice of a big pie is better than no pie, or what does that look like? But what about you, Stuart?
So because we invest relatively early in their journey, we know that it's important that this could be end up being, is likely to end up being anywhere 5, 7, 10 year journey for it, if it's going to be a great success. And we know that the people we're investing in need to have enough skin in the game or feel like they have enough upside to see that journey through. Because if they drop out at certain stages, that can be detrimental to the success of the company. So we go by the very rough rule of thumb that each stage the company will dilute or give away anywhere between 10 and at the upper end 30%, but more likely 25% of their equity at each round. And depending on the company and entrepreneur, they will realize that. Others, if they're protected, particularly if they're more from academia, will not have such a good idea with that, but then we can help them model that out. One thing which I do think is quite interesting, which I've noticed, is speaking to, let's say, spin-out companies from universities, from academia in the US, a number of the companies we've invested in started off in academia, and those institutions will often own an equity stake in that company, but it will be in the single digit range. And then they'll have some sort of royalty payments, likewise, as milestones are hit and on future revenues. From speaking to some UK companies who've also spun out of universities recently, I'm seeing that actually that the figure which the university takes is much closer to that 40%, 50% mark straight off the bat, which as, this is me postulating, but I imagine that could also then have quite an impact on someone's desire to see through what is a very difficult 5-10 year journey, given that there's already half the company which has been allocated to the university. And I don't know what that right figure is. It's probably somewhere in the middle, because the universities often have contributed in terms of education and resources. But to not have 40% of your company, 45% straight off the bat, knowing that you've probably got 3-4 rounds of further dilution, and if you're a team of 2 or 3 co-founders, you're already starting only with 15-16% anyway, they very quickly end up with a low single digit figure. Okay. And whilst it is a larger pie, I think there's a balance there of what they need to be motivated enough to see that through.
I agree, and I think as someone who obviously works part time in the university and is helping others with that, I think there's the universities have to be much more clear about what it is they brought to the project. It was previously just along the lines of, well, we gave you the opportunity to meet these people you're now working with, and you've got the lab, and they could go down a long list. But actually, tangibly, what does that mean? And the important thing, as you're saying, is who's keeping skin in the game? Arguably, the university is the only one keeping skin in the game. The irony is that they're the only ones not doing anything. I would suggest to people working in those environments to have those conversations much more clearly with the universities and have in their mind what they need to get from it. Now, if the university is continuing to employ you for that whole route and to work on it, then that's one part of it. But actually, for a lot of projects that are not going to be anywhere near a unicorn, the universities have the opportunity to consider what the marketing payoff of getting something done with a very happy team is compared to having a percentage of what may end up being a small product. So I think there's conversations that should be had more regularly around that. I think people should, and that's part of why I wanted to have this, bring this up now with both of you, is to encourage people to think about what is real, what is normal, and what is realistic. And therefore, if a team like yours, Stuart, is gonna come in and expect somewhere between the areas you're saying, sort of 20 to 35, whatever it is, percent. But what you're bringing with that, which is, I'm assuming, not just the money, but actually some really great critical friends, some oversight, some other working understanding of the market, is that not more value than just it is where you're working? So I invite people to do a lot of research on that before they get into any negotiations.
Can I just jump in there with just one other quick thought? I'd like to ask what you think about the value of incubator and accelerator programs, because I know there's one I work on in Oxford where companies very early stage can join an incubator program for very, very little IP. And the benefits in an early stage I've seen are incredible, because they are, that means that new startup company is working with other startups. They have access to information from a very wide range of sources. And without relinquishing an enormous amount of value, it can be as small as 5%, they can spend up to 6 months to 9 months in development with other very valuable people who are there to support and help them. And following on from that, costly mistakes later on. And it also helps them to see specifically what kind of investment they need above and beyond the finances, what kind of support would help them accelerate faster. And I just wondered what your views were on that.
Yeah, so we've invested in companies that have come out of, let's say, most of the renowned accelerators out there. So in the US, that might be Y Combinator or IndieBio. In the UK, there's one called Rebel Bio, which is linked to IndieBio, and Entrepreneur First. And there are a number and an increasingly growing number of accelerators and incubators which now exist. And I think the important thing with all of them is that they aren't created equal, and some are much more beneficial than others in terms of both the offering, in terms of how much you're getting in terms of cash for what percentage, and in terms then of expertise and the help that you can get. But as a general rule, I think if you are early stage, particularly if you are coming from academia and don't necessarily have much commercial expertise, I think they can be a great path to go down. But I would definitely qualify that with saying, speak to other companies who have been through that process, particularly med tech and health tech companies, because most accelerators out there tend not to focus on those that are more generic, and see what experience they had. But yeah, as a very high level opinion, I'm very pro people going into accelerators and incubators if they can get if there are things that they can get out of it, such as a bit more commercial experience or contacts, fundraising, whatever that target is.
Thanks, Stuart. Well, just sort of wrapping up, I've got a couple of questions, but the first one from somebody's asking about the name of the guide, Angela, that you mentioned at the beginning, which was a good resource. Could you mention that reference again?
Oh, absolutely. So it was produced by Innovate UK and BSI, and it's called the PAS, so the Publicly Available Specification 440/2020, and it was released on the 31st of March, and it's currently available, I believe, on the, yes, I'm sure I'm right, on the BSI website, so you can download it free of charge. And all BSI and Innovate UK are asking for is to make sure it's valuable and actually can be developed further. They're inviting feedback from anyone who does download it. It's a really good resource. It's an interesting read, and I think it gives a very good overview.
Thanks. I've got one last question. Really, I think this is one for you, Angela, about the advice for startups on the subject of human factors as part of design. And maybe Matthew as well. I mean, just really quickly, what's your view on, what would your advice be on the human factor side?
I think the more research that can be done, do as much as you possibly can. I think it's invaluable. Start off with anyone you can cajole into listening to your idea and test it out on them, but be constantly informed and widen that reach as much as you possibly can. And I say that obviously with caution. People have to have awareness of their protecting their IP and making sure they're working and talking to people who can give them the right kind of feedback, but absolutely invaluable. And I think on that note, I'd just say very quickly that what's interesting in human factors and how looking at how something's going to be used, I think the other interesting thing we're seeing alongside that is how much societal attitudes towards technological change are shifting. Things that we wouldn't have used or welcomed a few years ago, we're now consumers are now welcoming them and using them, and those expectations will continue to shift at a really fast pace. So looking at how things are used and also aligning that with societal attitudes, I think will be really, really valuable in the future as people bring these new tools into their daily lives. They'll continually expect more and more.
No, thank you for that, Angela. So sort of finishing off really, what's the general feeling in medtech at the moment? I mean, we're in the middle of a COVID-19 pandemic, but I mean, Stuart, what's your thoughts of, why invest in medtech? And, you know, what's the general feeling out there? I mean, I've been watching the shares across the medtech industry and they bounce back quite strongly. Is there an optimism for the future out there, guys?
Yeah, I'm personally very optimistic. And even if we're just talking about COVID-19 and the impact there, I'm quite optimistic. Looking at some of the companies that we have invested in who are in the medical space, they've all of a sudden they've had very long sales cycles full of bureaucracy shortened incredibly quickly. If there's any hint that they might may be helpful in helping in some capacity, even sort of tangentially helping with what's going on at the moment. And I think once this has sped up a lot of adoption of different technologies, particularly digital technologies and ones which do facilitate remote health, be that through patients having devices at home, be that telemedicine, and I do think that's going to carry on and stay. And also very buoyed by, if you look at how quickly, as a global community, people have been able to bring potential vaccines or potential drugs to market, has been incredibly fast, right? And there's no reason that shouldn't be able to continue beyond COVID, rather than have a 8 to 10 year time frame to get something to market. It can be shown that actually you can have something in human trials in a matter of months, and that's encouraging. Whether or not that persists and lasts beyond the current crisis, we shall see. And then sort of taking one step higher, I just think generally the space, the sort of the confluence of medicine and now the advances in software and how software is now playing a part in across the medical stack, be it from drug discovery through to diagnostics through to medical device design, is exciting. If you look at where people, let's say the big technology companies like your Amazon, your Google, Microsoft, Apple, they're all looking at the tech space. That's very exciting because they will see that as the next big frontier. A lot of optimism from my part on the sector and the industry.
That's good to hear. And certainly from within the NHS, we're hearing of speeding up decision making and more digital, Zoom meetings. And that's encouraging to hear. Well, we've gone a little bit over, but I think it's been a really interesting conversation. I really appreciate participation, Angela, Matthew and Stuart. And thank you for the questions from the audience today. So we'll sort of wrap up and thank you again for attending this device access webinar. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.